Good evening, and welcome to this evening's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Karen Kiefer, a member of the club's International Relations Member-Led Forum, and your chair for this evening's program. We also welcome our listeners on the radio, and we invite our audience to visit us online at www.commonwealthclub.org. And now it is my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker for this evening. The New York Review of Books stated that William Schultz has done more than anyone in the American human rights movement to make human rights issues known in the United States. From the refugee camps of Darfur, Sudan, to the poorest villages in India, from the prison cells of Monrovia, Liberia, to the business suites of Hong Kong, and to Louisiana's death row, the Reverend Dr. William F. Schultz has traveled the globe in pursuit of a world free from human rights violations. Currently, Dr. Schultz is president and CEO of the Unitarian Universalist Service Committee. He also provides consulting services to the funder Humanity United, and serves as adjunct professor of public administration at New York University's Wagner School of Public Service. He is also an affiliated professor at Meadville Lombard Theological School at the University of Chicago. There's seats up here. As executive director of Amnesty International USA from 1994 to 2006, Dr. Schultz headed the American section of the world's oldest and largest international human rights organization. From 2006 to 2010, he was a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, specializing in human rights, and has served as a consultant to a variety of foundations, including the MacArthur Foundation, the United Nations Foundation, and Kellogg Foundation. An ordained Unitarian Universalist minister, Dr. Schultz was president of the Unitarian Universalist Association of Congregations from 1985 to 1993. He served on the boards of People for the American Way, Planned Parenthood Federation of America, and many other organizations, and he is a member of the Council on Foreign Relations. A frequent guest on television programs such as Good Morning America, The Today Show, Hardball, and Nightline, let's welcome Dr. Schultz to the podium.
Thanks so much. Thank you, Karen, for your kind introduction, and greetings to all of you. It's a delight to see so many of my friends, my Unitarian Universalist friends. When I was speaking around the country for Amnesty International, wherever I went, I would see a group of folks who came in. Most of them were in Birkenstocks and long hair and tied, and I'd say, they're the Unitarian Universalists. They're here. So it's a delight to see all of you, and I want especially to welcome and to greet my dear friend Rosemary Mattson, who has been an inspiration to so many of us for so many years, to so many of us who care about social justice and human rights. And Rosemary is sitting right up front so that she can hear me, and that's good, because a number of years ago I spoke at Pepperdine University down in Malibu, and I thought I'd given a rousing address. And afterwards, a woman came up to me and she said, Dr. Schultz, I couldn't hear a word you said tonight. And thinking to be modest, I said, well, you're probably not missing much. And she said, yes, I know. That's what everybody told me. So, Rosemary, I hope you don't have the same experience this evening. This talk is entitled, Do Human Rights Have a Future? And actually, that's a bit of a tease, because my ability to predict the future is about on a par with that of Calvin Coolidge's. And now let's test your San Francisco history. What happened two blocks from here that affected the life of Calvin Coolidge very significantly? Do you know?
Warren Harding.
That's right. Warren Harding died at the Palace Hotel, and Calvin Coolidge became president. And when Calvin Coolidge became president, he was asked what would happen with the economy. And Coolidge said, if people lose their jobs, unemployment will result. And I think that's probably true, and that's about as good as my prognosticatory abilities. It's a tease, secondly, because of course human rights have a future. The question is, what kind of one? Now, on one level, the answer appears obvious. Robert Frost said that poems begin with a lump in the throat. And human rights do too, and they have done so for almost 4,000 years, back until back to 1740 BC, when King Hammurabi codified his laws against torture and slavery. At the end of the day, the reason that any one of us cares about human rights is because we feel sick at heart at the sight of misery. But the question is, whose misery? Because, you see, King Hammurabi's strictures against torture and slavery applied only to his own people, the Babylonians. As for the Assyrians, his arch enemies, well, you could torture and enslave Assyrians all you wanted. And similarly, the guiding documents of the French Revolution, the Declaration of the Rights of Man and the Citizen, of the U.S. Bill of Rights, these helped the French and the Americans, but they did nothing for the Thai or the Congolese. There's an old Chinese saying that I have always loved. You can stand on a hillside for a long, long time with your mouth wide open before a roast duck will fly in. And it took almost that long. It took a very long time for human beings to feel sick at heart at the sight of everybody's misery, not just the misery of my own clan or tribe or nation. Indeed, it was not until 1948, which was 3,688 years after Hammurabi, that the people of the world managed to agree that everybody's misery mattered. That, of course, was the year the United Nations adopted the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And if you consider that before 1948, the concept of universal human rights didn't even exist in any formally recognized way, then the progress that we have made in the last 62 years, from that perspective, has been enormous. Shortly before I left my position at Amnesty International in 2006, I gave a lecture at Syracuse University, and at the dinner beforehand, the president of the university posed a question to me and about a dozen or two dozen faculty members who were at dinner. He said, "Are human rights better or worse off today than they were 200 years ago?" And with one exception, all of the faculty members insisted that human rights were in worse shape today than they had been two millennia before. And after listening to all this moaning, I could not contain myself further, and I said in my customarily tactful way, "Are you folks nuts?" I said, "Why, just in the 12 years that I've been with Amnesty, we've seen a huge growth in democracy around the globe. We've seen war crimes tribunals for the former Yugoslavia, Rwanda, Sierra Leone. We've seen the British law lords rule in 1999 that Augusto Pinochet was not protected by the concept of sovereign immunity and could be prosecuted for his crimes. We've seen the creation of the International Criminal Court. We've seen all but two countries, Somalia and the United States, ratify the Convention on the Rights of the Child. We've seen the U.S. Supreme Court rule unconstitutional the execution of children and the mentally retarded. And you don't think that we are better off today than in 1806 when a slaveholder, Thomas Jefferson, could get elected president of the United States?" But these, of course, these were academics, so that had absolutely no influence or impact upon them whatsoever. I will say that the one faculty member who agreed with me was David Crane, who was a law professor at Syracuse and the former prosecutor of the War Crimes Tribunal in Sierra Leone. So David had seen firsthand what had changed. And indeed, had I been responding to those professors today, I would have added that perhaps the most promising development in the past 10 years has been the explosion of the number of human rights groups that exist around the world and the growing sophistication of their techniques. The Holocaust Museum did a recent study and identified 115 organizations working on the prevention of genocide alone, just that subject, and the 12 major ones were all founded in the past 5 years. That's remarkable. And the same is true of national and regional human rights organizations. Virtually every country, even some of the most repressive like Belarus or Cambodia, can now boast indigenous human rights groups which track violations, report abuses. And these proliferating groups no longer have to rely upon just 20th century techniques. We all know, of course, about the Twitter-organized protests, but satellite imaging, for example, is regularly being used to enforce human rights, to identify, for example, slave labor camps in North Korea, or to offer protection to villages that were at risk in Darfur. We all remember that Martin Luther King, quoting actually a Unitarian minister, Theodore Parker, famously proclaimed that the arc of the universe is long, but it bends toward justice. And if you look at the human rights struggle over the past 200 years or the past 62 years or even the past 12 years, you would have good reason to think they were right. So, if everything looks so rosy, why do I bother to ask, do human rights have a future? And of course the answer is because I'm telling you the good news. The fact is that after having reached an historic peak 4 years ago, the number of true democracies in the world is now in decline, as witness Venezuela. And according to Freedom House, it stands at the lowest level since 1995. Even with the reversal of President Obama of some of the Bush administration's greatest excesses in the war on terror, many governments continue to label their peaceful political opponents as terrorists and use that as an excuse for deprivation of their political opponents. Violence against women is still evident all over this world. In far too many places, women are still regarded as second, third, or even fourth-class citizens. China has become far more aggressive in promoting the notion that economic success, capitalism, does not require political freedom, contrary to what the West has maintained for so long. And here in the United States, of course, economic stress has prompted rampant anti-immigrant sentiment and a decline in the degree to which the U.S., once a leader in advocating human rights around the world, makes them a priority in its relations with other countries. So, what does the future of human rights hold? Well, here are five issues to watch which will tell us a lot about where human rights are going. I put them in the form of five questions. What will happen next in the Middle East? Will the International Criminal Court ever convict anybody? Will China give an inch in its resistance to human rights? Will the definition of human rights stay stagnant? And will the United States ever reclaim the mantle of human rights leadership? So, of course, the first question, I suppose, before all of our minds is, what will happen next in the Middle East? We have all watched with awe and not a little trepidation the developments there. What all of these instances in Tunisia, Egypt, Syria, Yemen, what they all tell us is that authoritarian regimes are far more brittle than they appear. It is, of course, far too early to tell the ultimate resolution of these transformative events. The elections in Tunisia were promising. The elections last week in Egypt lead to trepidation. No question about that. Egyptian liberals, we know, are dismayed. Though interesting enough, I will say that the challenge to the Muslim Brotherhood from the extremist Salafi faction may well force the Brotherhood to adopt a more moderate governing style than it might otherwise have been inclined to. And here, as in so many other places, how women fare will ultimately be a plumb line against which to measure the long-term success or failure of the revolution. But regardless of the final outcomes, the events in the Middle East have been enormously important for human rights for at least four reasons. First, because they have put the lie to the canard that Islam is incompatible with movements for democracy and human rights. Now, that misconception should have been discredited long ago, inasmuch as Indonesia, which is the world's largest Muslim country, has long been a committed, if messy, democracy. But it is now impossible to contend that Islamic countries are somehow inherently averse to human rights principles. There's no question that some elements, of course, within Islam disparage human rights and democracy and the role of women, but it is obvious that huge numbers of Tunisians and Egyptians and Libyans and Syrians chafed under autocratic restrictions and were prepared to risk their lives to be released from them. And the emergence of Turkey, I should say, as with its moderate Islamic government as a model, as a leader of Islamic countries, this is an enormously important development for human rights. 15 years ago, Turkey was considered one of the worst human rights offenders, and it is certainly true that Turkey still has its problems, particularly in relationship to its Kurdish minority. But Turkey has cleaned up its act in an enormous number of ways, and the fact that Turkey is serving as a model for others is a profoundly hopeful sign. So that's the first reason. The second reason these changes are so important for human rights is because they have dealt blows to the credibility of Al-Qaeda, of China, and of Iran. Al-Qaeda's insistence that terrorism is the only tool by which to transform sclerotic governments has been turned on its head by the revolutions, the Arab Spring. And whose political system did the Middle East revolutionaries look to for inspiration? Certainly it was not the Chinese. It was not the Iranian models of that they looked to for inspiration. Quite apart from China's embarrassing violation of the UN arms embargo against Gaddafi, the Chinese government is terrified that its own citizens will find the revolutions in the Middle East more than a mere curiosity. And Iran, you may remember that Ahmadinejad gave the astonishing advice to the Syrian government that it should cease its crackdown on dissent. That only belies Iran's own anxiety that the spirit of democracy will spread there. The third reason these Arab Spring events are so important to human rights is because they put pressure on Israel to finally get serious about peace with the Palestinians. Now, Israel has long been a convenient whipping boy for autocratic governments to use to divert attention from their own failures while they maintained a cold peace with the Jewish state. And with anti-Israeli sentiment now fully released throughout the Middle East, Israel finds itself more isolated than ever, and its natural tendency will be to redouble its defensive posture. But cooler heads in Israel know that whether or not Palestine be recognized as an independent state doesn't matter. A two-state solution is the only way to guarantee Israel's long-term security. That's an important element in the development of the Arab Spring. And finally, what happened in Libya is enormously important for the future of human rights. In 2005, the United Nations did a remarkable thing when it adopted the principle of the responsibility to protect. It committed the international community to respond, including militarily, whenever a government started committing massive crimes against its own people. For 6 years, the UN managed to assiduously avoid living up to its responsibilities to protect in Darfur, in Sudan, in Congo. But then came Libya, and on the invitation of the Arab League, as we know, the UN responded, albeit belatedly, with high resolve, And the rebel and NATO victory in Libya has to sow a seed of doubt in the head of every future autocrat. Might the international community be serious this time? Might I suffer the fate of Gaddafi if I terrify my own people? It's certainly true that not every situation lends itself to a military response. But Libya, and Kosovo before it, by the way, a forgotten war, but a critically important instance of humanitarian intervention on behalf of human rights, Libya and Kosovo have established the principle that sovereignty does not mean immunity from the enforcement of human rights standards. And that is a breakthrough proposition for human rights. But in the last analysis, revolutions are an unreliable way to enforce human rights. If the world has no legal mechanism to deal with dictators, the people will inevitably take matters into their own hands, but the results may or may not be propitious for human rights. We know plenty of revolutions that have not resulted in a more positive human rights situation. Now, can you imagine a situation in a society which outlawed theft, rape, murder, but had no police to enforce the laws and no courts to adjudicate them? Well, that's the situation at the international level. The world still has no police, no sheriff, to enforce international law. But ever since 2002, it has had a court that is authorized to prosecute genocide, war crimes, and crimes against humanity. The International Criminal Court has the potential to be the most transformative development in the human rights field since the passage of the Universal Declaration. But the question is, will the ICC ever convict anybody? The ICC has indicted about a dozen people, including the sitting president of Sudan, but so far only one person, a man named Thomas Lubanga, who is a rebel leader in Congo accused of employing child soldiers, so far only Lubanga has been brought to trial, and no one has yet been convicted. What's worse, the court has been characterized by chaotic administration. It's been chastised frequently by the judges for sloppy prosecutions. The stakes here are enormous. If the ICC is discredited, the best hope for the way to hold tyrants to account for human rights crimes without having to resort to military force will be lost. And if that happens, the ICC's critics, including in this country, will be delighted, and the other group of people that will be delighted is the tyrants around the world. Now, I will say that last week, largely unnoticed, a rather promising development occurred. You may not remember the name Laurent Gbagbo, but Gbagbo was the former strongman in Côte d'Ivoire who a year or more ago refused to step down after he lost re-election. Gbagbo was transferred to the International Criminal Court last week for trial for the atrocities committed in the aftermath of his intransigence. It seems like a small thing, but it's actually a very important thing for two reasons. First, because he, unlike Gaddafi, was not killed by his adversaries after they took power. Instead, he was taken into custody, protected, and transferred to the court. That's an important precedence. And secondly, because all of the parties involved in resolving the Côte d'Ivoire dispute, including the United States, which has steadfastly opposed the ICC, all of the parties agreed that the ICC was the credible body, the appropriate body, before which to resolve these questions of Gbagbo's guilt or innocence. A small development, but an important one. But some tyrants, of course, are outside the reach of the court. China, for example. China has not ratified its statutes, neither, of course, has the U.S. or Russia or Israel. So China is not subject to its jurisdiction. You may remember when President Clinton was in office back in 1993, he extended most favored nation trade status to China, and he said he was convinced that economic growth was the surest path to greater respect for human rights in China, because a more robust middle class, he said, would eventually demand its rights. Well, China has had a growth of close to 10% a year in its GDP, and we are farther than ever from greater respect for human rights. President Clinton was wrong about a few things, and that was certainly one of them. Nor, I might say, have social networking tools brought China to its heels. In China, despite the government's best efforts to erect a firewall against uncontrolled internet access, that access does grow every day, and yet the free flow of information has not by itself toppled the regime. So the third question I ask is, will China ever give an inch when it comes to human rights? It is, of course, the world's most populous country. It is an emerging power. Its record, its views on human rights are critically important to the future of human rights. The fact is that China is the largest wild card in the deck when it comes to the future of human rights. It is not only a singularly proficient violator of human rights itself. There are more than 100,000 people, for example, in prison in China without fair trial. But it is also the preeminent suborner of human rights violations in other countries. It props up repressive regimes in places like Sudan and Zimbabwe through its unscrupulous investment policies. And it blocks efforts by the international community to enforce human rights elsewhere in the globe because it is so afraid that those same standards will be applied to itself. Well, there are two possible sources of transformation in China. The first, of course, is the Chinese people. Largely unbeknownst to the outside world, Chinese citizens carry on vibrant protests, even riots, with regularity over disputes involving land or corruption or environmental degradation. And as long as the targets of those protests are local officials, the national government usually lets them take their course. But it's not inconceivable that frustrations will eventually spill over to the national level. And then it is anybody's guess as to the consequences. The Chinese government is terrified of that. And the second possible source of change is China's desperate need to be seen as a respected player in the international community. Think about it for a minute. Why would a country spend millions of dollars trying to bribe other countries not to attend a purely symbolic event, namely the awarding of the Nobel Peace Prize to Liu Xiaobo, an event which was of no direct threat to Chinese interests whatsoever? And yet China spent millions and millions of dollars bribing countries to stay away from the ceremony. Why? Because for all its expressions of disdain for international opinion about human rights, the Chinese crave the world's approval. And eventually, they may come to recognize that the only way to truly win that respect and approval will be to conform to international norms. And that is why it is so important that the United States, the European Union, and human rights NGOs keep up the pressure on Chinese human rights violations, even when the task seems hopeless, because absent such attention, these norms may atrophy, and there will be no incentive for the Chinese to mend their errant ways. And if we doubt that change in a repressive country is possible, we have but to look at Burma. The events going on in Burma today are absolutely astonishing. Now, will the Burmese thaw be permanent, or will it prove elusive? I have absolutely no idea, but we must watch that situation very carefully if we care about the future of human rights, because if Burma can change, almost any regime can change. And the change in Burma is at least in part a result of two things. One is the effectiveness in this case of economic sanctions, and two is, once again, the desire of the Burmese leadership to be a respected player in the international community, and especially, specifically in ASEAN, the Association of Southeast Asian Nations. Well, notice, though, to this point, something about every single one of the human rights issues that I've been talking about. Every single one of them concern civil and political rights, the traditional notions of human rights. That's what we all think about when we talk about human rights. And yet, there is a whole set of rights of a very different nature. And that's why the fourth question I ask is, will our notion of human rights remain stagnant? Or will we come to recognize that social and economic rights, such as those that the organization I currently head, the Unitarian Universalist Service Committee, works on, rights such as the right to water or the right to a fair wage, that these rights are every bit as important as civil and political rights? In fact, if you believe that having enough food to eat or water to drink or adequate shelter to live is a higher human need, a higher order human need than, say, having the right to vote, then you might want to argue that social and economic rights are the most important rights, more important than civil and political rights. There's a lot of misinformation abroad in the land, especially, about social and economic rights. They are not tantamount to socialism. They do not require governments to give free handouts to their citizens. They simply require that everyone have equitable access to meet their basic human needs. You know, during the 2008 presidential campaign, the second debate, Senator Obama and Senator McCain were both asked whether health care was a right or a responsibility. McCain said it was a responsibility of businesses. Obama said it was a right, and he cited his mother's experience with cancer and her failure to receive economic support in that period. But you'll also notice that throughout the great debates around Obamacare, health was not ever framed in terms of human rights, and that's because it is not seen as a selling marketing strategy here in the United States. But the truth is that Obamacare has come closer than we have ever come before to recognizing the fundamental universal right to health care. And if the Supreme Court overturns Obamacare, that will not just be a defeat for that particular piece of legislation. It will be a profound setback for the whole notion of social and economic rights as rights to be claimed in this country, along with the traditional civil and political with which we are so familiar. My guess is that the answer to this fourth question I'm asking, will we expand our understanding of human rights to entail all the rights contained in the Universal Declaration, not just some of them? My guess is that the answer to this question will be the most important and transformative of all the ones that I've put before you this evening. Finally, I want to ask whether the United States will ever reclaim the mantle of human rights leadership. The United States has always understood itself to be a champion of human rights around the world. Indeed, there would be no such thing as the contemporary human rights movement had Franklin Roosevelt not declared in 1941 that there were four freedoms that every human being on earth could claim: freedom of speech, freedom of religion, freedom from want, an economic right, by the way, and freedom from fear. And 7 years later, Eleanor Roosevelt led the effort to make these freedoms more concrete with the adoption of the Universal Declaration. Over the years, the United States has led the charge to defend many of those rights around the world. And here, let me just say parenthetically that for all the criticisms that I and we at Amnesty International made of the United States during the Bush administration, for all the very justified criticisms that we made, this is also true. Whenever we in Amnesty traveled around the world and went to a capital and sought allies in the diplomatic corps to speak to local governments on behalf of prisoners of conscience, we could almost always be assured that the U.S. Embassy would take up our cause, even in the midst of the Bush administration. In fact, I will tell you a little story that always amuses me. Shortly before the election, just a few days before the 2008 election, I was in Geneva speaking to a group of world parliamentarians. And of course, naturally, the parliamentarians spent most of their time attacking me for the United States' record, that is, for President Bush's human rights record. And finally, I got up and I said, you know, ladies and gentlemen, you've really picked the wrong American to defend President Bush's human rights record. But I will say this to you, ma'am, from Singapore, and to you, sir, from Mali, and to you, sir, from Belarus. I will say that if you had been even half as critical of your prime minister or president as I have been of mine, you would not be with us here today. I assure you that. So, during the years of the Bush administration, there is no question but what the U.S.'s reputation for leadership, moral leadership, human rights leadership declined dramatically, and the Obama administration, of course, has slowed that decline. Tempting as it is, though, to attribute all of our problems to one president or one party and assume their complete eradication by the other, such simplistic thinking, it's appealing, I suppose, but it will ultimately not do. After all, I have to say, I'm from Massachusetts, where a few years ago, it was a Democratic state senator who got on statewide radio one night and proclaimed in loud and fervent tones, "The Republican octopus is spreading its testicles across the entire Commonwealth." The hard truth is that the decline in our reputation for human rights was rooted not just in the personality of George Bush, but in a predilection of the American character that goes way back to the founding of the country. Maybe it's because both their names begin with P, but Americans have a hard time distinguishing between the Pilgrims and the Puritans. The Pilgrims were the ones who arrived at Plymouth Rock in 1620, to escape religious persecution. The Puritans came 10 years later under Governor John Winthrop, not because they were being persecuted, but in order to found a religious utopia, a more pure community, a new Jerusalem, the famous city set on a hill. And both the city and the hill part were important. The Mass Bay colony was, of course, to be a city of great virtue. Here are the minutes of an early town meeting that capture that perfectly. "We passed 3 resolutions," the minutes read. "Voted first that the earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof. Voted second that the earth is given to the saints. Voted third that we are the saints." But what good, of course, was sainthood if nobody knew about your saintliness? So the hill part, you see, was just as important. That city was to be set not in a valley where no one could see it, but on a hill where it was visible to all. Winthrop said, "The eyes of all people will be upon us, and if we succeed, they shall say of later plantations, 'Lord, Lord, make ours like that of New England.'" And so you see, from the very beginning, the country saw itself as a model for the less enlightened to emulate. And that sense of moral mission has never left us. So when George Bush declared in his second inaugural that it is the policy of the United States to support the growth of democracy in every nation and culture with the ultimate goal of ending all tyranny in the world, he was hearkening back to that age-old American assumption embodied, among other places, in the Declaration of Independence, the assumption that proclaimed the value of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, not just for Americans, not just for British citizens, but for, in the words of the Declaration, all mankind. Sorry, Rosemary, but it was the Declaration of Independence. All mankind. That assumption is reflected every time a preacher or a politician refers to the United States as the greatest country on the face of the earth. So this predilection to believe in America's exceptional qualities and transforming mission, it's an old one, and it is exactly what led to the notion that America is exempt from the rules by which everybody else must play. And our reputation for human rights leadership declined because we indulge the narrow, paternalistic inclinations of the American character, a disdain for international covenants, a hypersensitivity to maintaining our own sovereignty, a suspicion of international institutions, a scapegoating of immigrants. So will the U.S. reclaim its proud history? Well, fortunately, I have to say that that part of the American tradition that I just referenced is not the only one that there is. There is another part of the American tradition upon which to draw, a tradition of generosity and hospitality, rescue, liberation, decency, virtue. And that part of the American tradition is manifest in a Roger Williams, who thought that the early colonists ought to actually pay the Indians for the land that they had appropriated. What a quaint idea. And Roger Williams, of course, was exiled to the great wilderness of Rhode Island. It's manifested in a Judge Samuel Sewall, one of the judges at the Salem witchcraft trials, who only 5 years later got up in front of his own church and with tears running down his face made public confession of apology for his role in the witchcraft trials. It's manifest in the Bill of Rights. It's manifest in a Lydia Maria Child demanding an end to slavery and in an Elizabeth Cady Stanton expressing outrage when the World Anti-Slavery Society denied delegate status to women. It's manifest in a Sojourner Truth leading the slaves to freedom. It's manifest in a Lincoln offering his adversaries 4 weeks before the end of the Civil War, offering his adversaries malice toward none and charity for all. Imagine what would happen to a U.S. president today if those words were spoken before the end of the war, of a war about the country's enemies or adversaries. It's manifest in the defeat of fascism. It's manifest in Truman's support for the United Nations right in this city. It's manifest in Eisenhower's stirring conviction in his 1958 State of the Union address that the only answer to a regime that wages total Cold War is to wage total peace. It's manifest in the civil rights movement. It's manifest in the resistance that we are seeing to those pinched souls who would not be where they are today if their immigrant ancestors had been treated the way they proposed to treat the latest generation of new Americans. And it is manifest in the courage of those lawyers, many of them military lawyers, who have defended prisoners at Guantanamo Bay at the expense of their careers. Draw upon this part of the American tradition, and indeed we will regain our leadership, because at the end of the day, human rights emerge out of the common misery of humankind, signaled as it is by that lump in the throat, the sad but gentle truth that the angel of death perches on the shoulders of every one of us, that every one of us is mortal, every one of us is fragile and vulnerable. And in the face of that truth, human rights give voice to our deepest yearnings, yearnings for things like a reconciliation with our adversaries, an eradication of fear, a better life for our children, a fair distribution of the earth's abundance, not an equal distribution, just a fair distribution. One last story. In the midst of the 1994 Rwandan genocide, a girls' school was attacked in the middle of the night by machete-wielding militiamen. The teenagers were rousted from their beds about 2 a.m. and forced to line up in the dining hall. And then they were ordered to separate themselves by ethnic group, Hutu from Tutsi, so that only the Tutsi would die. But not a one of the girls moved. And for a second time, the militia commander ordered them, Hutu over here, Tutsi over there. And for a second time, not a one of the girls moved. And finally, one of the girls, naturally terrified, raised her hand timorously. I'm sorry, sir, she said. I'm sorry, sir, but we cannot separate ourselves. We cannot separate ourselves, sir, because, you see, in this school, we are not Hutu. We are not Tutsi. We're all just little Rwandan girls. At which point, every one of the girls was slaughtered. But what a legacy they leave. We are not Hutu. We are not Tutsi. We're all just little Rwandan girls.
And that sentiment expresses what is most fundamental about human rights, that we are all in this together. And the echoes of that young girl's voice bespeak a graciousness for which the world is desperate. Human rights do have a future, and how vibrant it will be depends upon our capacity to remember the fragility that we all share. Thank you.
Our very much appreciation to you, Dr. Schultz, for your very interesting and informative presentation this evening. We'd like to remind our listening audience that this is a program that of the Commonwealth Club of California, and you are listening to Do Human Rights Have a Future with Dr. William Schultz. I'm Karen Kiefer, a member of the club's International Relations Member-Led Forum, and this is our question and answer period. Please raise your hand if you have a question.
Hi, my name is Helena Brook, and I am a Unitarian. The United States is certainly a far better place to live and as a woman than many, many places throughout the world. But I'm gravely worried that as a woman in our culture, women in our culture, that we're kind of like the frog in hot water. The fact that we've never passed the Equal Rights Amendment, that more and more of the reproductive rights throughout the states are being cut off. And I'm worried that too many women don't seem to have any thoughts that this is a real issue. What are your thoughts on about how to deal with that?
I think there is no question that what you say is true in this country. I think that there is a generation of younger women who have not experienced that struggle, who do not recognize necessarily how difficult that has been to win even as much as has been won to this point. There are always regressive forces at work in every society, and certainly we are seeing that with regard to the issue of reproductive rights. There's no question about that. Because of the economic situation in the country today, that issue is not in the forefront of political debate in the way that it was before, and that, of course, has certain advantages, but it also has disadvantages because it means that there is less of a tendency to mobilize in defense of that issue. So I have no quarrel at all with how you've characterized this current situation.
Yes, I'd like to draw the audience's attention to a lawsuit that was filed last year called Holder versus Humanitarian Law Project. Are you familiar with that?
No.
Very briefly, this was the Humanitarian Law Project attempted to help, quote, terrorist groups, unquote, to find peaceful resolution to their grievances through the United Nations. The United States government has ruled that this is illegal, that they are giving aid and comfort to terrorists and therefore are committing treason. Now, this was upheld last year by the United States Supreme Court, and everyone should know about it.
Okay.
Good evening. I appreciate your 4 points on the future of human rights, and I just would like to ask you to think of a fifth with me. And that is the power of the rule of law, and in particular, the European Convention on Human Rights. Because when people think about the future of human rights, it's so rare that that's actually taken into consideration, yet that whole system is one of the best protections or the best protection for human rights in the world today. So I would like your thoughts about that process and how we might use it as a model internationally. Thank you.
Well, you're absolutely right, and there's no question but what the European Convention, the European Court of Human Rights, is a groundbreaking convention and groundbreaking institution. It has been a model for many other states as they have written their new constitutions. And it has also had an enormous influence over a country like Turkey, as Turkey was at least at one point eager to become part of the European Union, it cleaned up its act in several respects. Again, as I said, Turkey is far from perfect today, but it's certainly a better place in human rights terms than it was 15 years ago, and in large measure that is because the norms and the models of the European Union. Now, this is the way human rights law changes and human rights standards change. Because there is no universal legislature, because there is no one body that that rules except to some extent the UN Human Rights Council, but it is tainted in many respects by its own internal politics. The fact is that human rights grow in a progressive way through transformation of norms. And the leadership of the European Convention, of the European Union, of the European Court, and I will say of some other courts, such as the Inter-American Court for Human Rights, and even more recently some actions of the African Union, have been important steps in the transformation of those norms so that eventually the standards move, we hope, generally in a progressive direction. And that leadership has been enormously important.
My name is Ken Scudder. I've been trying to review the whole world in my head as to what you said, and I find a couple of real contradictions. It seems that you dwelled in terms of human rights violations probably more than half or primarily with countries that are not favored by the U.S., and also I thought in terms of the Middle East developments, that if you really look at the historical record over the last 20 years, the United States is by far the most destructive force, with the sanctions on Iraq and then as many as a million or more people killed by us there, that seems to outweigh the various awful but relatively petty dictatorships. And secondly, that just in regard to the, I know it's a big question, but question of the United States and Israel, where you have this virtually U.S., financed and sponsored, possibly, state, which by definition, by law, the indigenous population is not only second class within the state, but virtual prisoners elsewhere, and that's by the law of a Jewish state. So, well, that seems to be a real biggie, and I thought maybe you could have given it more time. Maybe you can. Thanks.
Well, any time one attempts to do a survey like this, people are probably going to disagree with emphases here and there. I will say this. The entire last fifth of my speech was about the fact that the United States has lost the mantle of human rights leadership, and an indication of how we might reclaim that. And if you know anything about Amnesty International and my history of leadership, you need have no concern that I have not been as fierce a critic of U.S. human rights violations as anyone. I will say I find offensive your notion that a petty dictatorship like China, the largest population in the world with the worst human rights record numerically of any country in the world, is not somehow worthy of our condemnation. Well, you referred to petty dictatorships. I think that China is an important country to pay attention to with regard to its human rights violations, and certainly Israel is too. Amnesty International and I have been consistently critical of Israeli human rights violations. But the truth is that that issue will never be resolved if both sides keep demonizing one another. That is simply the truth. And until we recognize that we have to move beyond that, if we're going to have a solution, we will not have a solution. And there will be continuing human rights violations on both sides of that conflict. That's the simple truth.
So this question comes from a personal fixation on human rights abuses in the agricultural supply chain and feeling, I guess, under-empowered in addressing them. Oh, I'm sorry. I've been thinking a lot about how we have very small voices and where the power is if we want to look at human rights abuses. And my question is, with the growth of multinationals, I guess really over the course of your career, how have you seen that shifting? What happens with human rights? And what does that play into in terms of the people in this room or the people listening to the broadcast?
There is certainly no question but what the role of corporations in human rights violation is critically important, and certainly I could have included that as one of the many factors if I'd had more time tonight. Absolutely the case. And you mentioned the agricultural supply chains. Certainly in terms of issues of slavery and trafficking, that is a major concern. There is no question but what some corporations have begun to recognize, that it is in their best interest to be a little more responsible in this respect. But there are no transnational standards and certainly no transnational enforcement. The United Nations special expert on business, John Ruggie, advisor to the Secretary General about corporations and social responsibility and human rights, has issued a wide variety of reports and encouraged the adoption of standards. But there are no enforcement mechanisms with corporations, any more than there truly are to this point with the International Criminal Court, except the voluntary compliance of certain nations in the case of the ICC and of certain corporations in the case of corporations. So you've identified absolutely an additional serious problem that will have profound impact on the future of human rights.
Great speech, Bill.
Thank you.
Would you comment on what's happened this last week or two back in Congress about how people accused of terrorism are now liable to be put in jail forever without right to a trial? Isn't that a giant step backward? And what direction are we going in?
I think absolutely. There's no question. And again, Amnesty International and I have fought this repeatedly for years since this was first initiated after 9/11. There is no question that the fact that U.S. citizens in particular can be apparently imprisoned without trial and without limits is a fundamental contradiction of the Constitution. But it is also true that whether one is a citizen or not, there are certain fundamental due process standards that the international human rights regimen recognizes, and those have not been abided by the United States. It's an enormous blot on our record.
Hi, I'm John Landers from Fremont. I'm sure you would agree that we won't have a whole lot of progress in human rights without advocacy. And so I'm wondering just how you deal with governments or the influential people. Do you work writing bills with committees, or do you go to the top and harangue, or do you meet them over cocktails? How is it done?
Well, all of the above, except probably the last. Both Amnesty and the Unitarian Universalist Service Committee are involved at a wide variety of levels. You know, one of the many of us, I suspect, may have some trouble with the Tea Party, but one of the things that its founders said that were profound is that in order to make social change, you have to act at every single level. You have to legislate, you have to advocate, you have to organize, and we in the human rights movement do all of the above. We are deeply involved. The Unitarian Universalist Service Committee is deeply involved in partnering with indigenous human rights groups around the world to build up that human rights voice and power in every country in which we work. We advocate here in the United States as well with the U.S. And our colleagues in the religious community. We have to do it all, or we will never be successful.
Looking over the globe and world history, do you see religion as more of a positive or a negative force for you?
Am I allowed to plead the fifth on that? Within every religious tradition, there are those who would keep their social systems closed, those who would narrow down the range of permissible actions, often of people of people who are not in positions of power, and that is true of every religious tradition. There is no question but what patriarchy and repression have been characteristic of elements within virtually every religious tradition. That is absolutely true. And they may have been predominant elements, at least at certain periods of time, in every religious tradition. And it is also true that most religious traditions have elements within them that are progressive and transformative. Religious communities are no different than every other social organization of human beings. There are those who try to exclude. There are those who try to assert power over others who are perceived to be less powerful, whether that be because of gender or ethnicity or tribe or belief. And there are others who try to keep society open, who try to keep the social system open. And I think we can look at virtually every single religious tradition and find both of those. And the fact is, this is the source of hope, I suppose. The fact is that in the long arc of history, the progressive forces always win. They always do. It's inevitable. But in the short term, we often experience our share of setbacks.
I believe I read that the International Criminal Court is having a meeting soon with elections and is thought to be a pivotal point in their evolution and their power.
Well,
what's your assessment?
There's not an election. The International Criminal Court, the judges, of course, are appointed. The court is, there are several critical factors that are at play in the court right now. One of them is what I mentioned, but it is also true that there is a debate as to whether the court should add to its docket of potential crimes the crime of war-making itself. That is very controversial, as you can imagine. There is also a new prosecutor who has just been appointed, it is a prosecutor from Africa, a woman. This is the first time there has been a prosecutor from Africa, even though I believe it's accurate to say that all of those indicted to this point have been African. And so that is probably a very important step. The current prosecutor is Latin American. And so it's probably an important step that the prosecutor be from the continent where so many of the indictees exist. I still have considerable hope for the ICC. If the court is able to successfully convict some of those before it, that will have to make a profound difference in the way the court is perceived. I mean, if you think about this a minute, how much more difficult would it have been for the United States to go into Iraq if there had been an alternative with regard to the treatment of Saddam Hussein? If one of the options had been to bring Hussein before the International Criminal Court for his massacre of the Kurds, let's say, it would have removed any excuse for U.S. military intervention. And eventually, the U.S. and others, I think, it is my faith, I can't prove this, but eventually, if the court is successful in some of these convictions, eventually, the U.S. will see that it is far more in our best interests to be part of the court and to make sure that there are no capricious prosecutions of Americans. That's fundamentally the reason that we've not joined the court, because there are those forces in this country that have convinced others that there may be capricious prosecution of Americans. That's not true, but I won't go into the details of why. Eventually, I think that will overcome that concern if the court is successful in some of these prosecutions.
Unfortunately, Bill, we've reached that time where have to close the program. So our thanks to Dr. Schultz for his interesting, very informative presentation. We also thank our audiences here as well as our radio audience. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California is adjourned.